because it dwelled on such things, reminding us how very much nature offers to the omnivore. The forests as much as the fields, the oceans as much as the meadows. If I had to give this dinner a name, it would have to be the omnivore's Thanksgiving. It's impossible to prepare and eat a meal quite so physically, intellectually, and emotionally costly without thinking about the incalculably larger debts we incur when we eat industrially, which is to say, when we eat without a thought to what we're doing. To compare my transcendently slow meal to the fast food meal I served my family at that McDonald's in Marin, the one that set me back $14 for the three of us and was consumed in 10 minutes at 65 miles per hour, is to marvel at the multiplicity of a world that could produce two such different methods of accomplishing the same thing. Feeding ourselves, I mean. The two meals stand at the far extreme ends of the spectrum of human eating, of the different ways we have to engage the world that sustains us. The pleasures of the one are based on a nearly perfect knowledge, the pleasures of the other on an equally perfect ignorance. The diversity of the one mirrors the diversity of nature, especially the forest. The variety of the other more accurately reflects the ingenuity of industry, especially its ability to tease a passing resemblance of diversity from a single species growing in a single landscape, a monoculture of corn. The cost of the first meal is steep, yet it is acknowledged and paid for. By comparison, the price of the second seems a bargain, but fails to cover its true cost, charging it instead to nature, to the public health and purse, and to the future. Let us stipulate that both of these meals are equally unreal and equally unsustainable, which is perhaps why we should do what a responsible social scientist would do under the circumstances. Discard them both as anomalies or outliers. Outliers of a real life. Or better yet, preserve them, but purely as ritual, for the lessons they have to teach us about the different uses to which the world can be put. Going to McDonald's would be something that happens once a year, a kind of Thanksgiving in reverse, and so would a meal like mine, as slow and storied as the Passover Seder. Without such a thing as fast food, there would be no need for slow food, and the stories we tell at such meals would lose much of their interest. Food would be, well, what it always was, neither slow nor fast, just food. This particular plant or that particular animal, grown here or there, prepared this way or that. For countless generations, eating was something that took place in the steadying context of a family and a culture, where the full consciousness of what was involved did not need to be rehearsed at every meal because it was stored away, like the good silver, in a set of rituals and habits, manners and recipes. I wonder if it isn't because so much of that context has been lost that I felt the need, this one time, to start again from scratch. This is not the way I want to eat every day. I like to be able to open a can of stock, and I like to talk about politics or the movies at the dinner table sometimes instead of food. But imagine for a moment if we once again knew, strictly as a matter of course, these few unremarkable things. What it is we're eating, where it came from, how it found its way to our table, and what, in a true accounting, it really cost. We could then talk about some other things at dinner, for we would no longer need any reminding that however we choose to feed ourselves, we eat by the grace of nature, not industry, and what we're eating is never anything more or less than the body of the world. This is Scott Brick. We hope that you've enjoyed this production of The Omnivore's Dilemma, A Natural History of Four Meals by Michael Pollan. This program was executive produced by Patty Peruse and produced by Dan Musselman. The Omnivore's Dilemma, A Natural History of Four Meals, is a production of Penguin Audio, a division of Penguin Group USA, Incorporated, and Books on Tape. Copyright 2006, all rights reserved. The book, The Omnivore's Dilemma, A Natural History of Four Meals, is available wherever Penguin Press books are sold. The story of the Naylor farm since 1919, when George's grandfather bought it, closely tracks the 20th century story of American agriculture, its achievements as well as its disasters. It begins with a farmer supporting a family on a dozen different species of plants and animals. There would have been a fair amount of corn then, too, but also fruits and other vegetables, as well as oats, hay, and alfalfa to feed the pigs, cattle, chickens, and horses, horses being the tractors of that time. One of every four Americans lived on farms when Naylor's grandfather arrived here in Sheridan. His land and labor supplied enough food to feed his family and 12 other Americans besides. Less than a century after, fewer than 2 million Americans still farm, and they grow enough to feed the rest of us. What that means is that Naylor's grandson, raising nothing but corn and soybeans on a fairly typical Iowa farm, is so astoundingly productive that he is, in effect, feeding some 129 Americans. Measured in terms of output per worker, American farmers like Naylor are the most productive humans who have ever lived. Yet George Naylor is all but going broke, and he's doing better than many of his neighbors, partly because he's still driving that 1975 tractor. For though this farm might feed 129, it can no longer support the four who live on it. The Naylor farm survives by the grace of Peggy Naylor's paycheck. She works for a social services agency in Jefferson, and an annual subsidy payment from Washington, D.C. Nor can the Naylor farm literally feed the Naylor family, as it did in Grandfather Naylor's day. George's crops are basically inedible. They're commodities that must be processed or fed to livestock before they can feed anyone. Water, water everywhere, and not a drop to drink. Like most of Iowa, which now imports 80% of its food, George's farm, apart from his garden, his laying hens, and his fruit trees, is basically a food desert. The 129 people who depend on George Naylor for their sustenance are all strangers, living at the far end of a food chain so long, intricate, and illegible that neither producer nor consumer has any reason to know the first thing about the other. Ask one of those eaters where their steak or soda comes from, and she'll tell you the supermarket. Ask George Naylor whom he's growing all that corn for, and he'll tell you the military-industrial complex. Both are partly right. I came to George Naylor's farm as an unelected representative of the group of 129, curious to learn who and what I'd find at the far end of the food chain that keeps me alive. There's no way of knowing whether George Naylor is literally growing the corn that feeds the steer that becomes my steak, or that sweetened my son's soft drink, or supplied the dozen or so corn-derived ingredients from which his chicken nugget is constructed. But given the complexly ramifying fate of a bushel of commodity corn, the countless forking paths followed by its 90,000 kernels as they're dispersed across the nation's sprawling food system, the odds are good that at least one of the kernels grown on the Naylor farm has, like the proverbial atom from Caesar's dying breath, made its way to me. And if not me, then certainly you. This Iowa cornfield, and all the others just like it, is the place most of our food comes from. Planting the City of Corn. The day I showed up was supposed to be the only dry one all week, so George and I spent most of it in the cab of his tractor, trying to get acquainted and get his last 160 acres of corn planted at the same time. A week or two later, he'd start in on the soybeans. The two crops take turns in these fields year after year, in what has been the classic Corn Belt rotation since the 1970s. Since that time, soybeans have become the second leg supporting the industrial food system. It, too, is fed to livestock and now finds its way into two-thirds of all processed foods. For most of the afternoon, I sat on a rough cushion George had fashioned for me from crumpled seed bags, but after a while, he let me take the wheel. Back and forth and back again, a half a mile in each direction. Planting corn feels less like planting, or even driving, than stitching an interminable cloak, or covering a page with the same sentence over and over again. The monotony, compounded by the roar of a diesel engine well past its prime, is hypnotic after a while. Every pass across this field, which is almost but not quite dead flat, represents another acre of corn planted, another 30,000 seeds tucked into one of the 8 furrows being simultaneously etched into the soil by pairs of stainless steel discs. A trailing roller then closes the furrows over the seed. The seed we were planting was Pioneer Hybrids 34H31, a strain that the catalog described as an adaptable hybrid with solid agronomics and yield potential. The lack of hype, notable for a seed catalog, probably reflects the fact that 34H31 does not contain the yield guard gene, the Monsanto-developed line of genetically engineered corn Pioneer is currently pushing. The modified 34B98 on the same page promises outstanding yield potential. Despite the promises, Naylor, unlike many of his neighbors, doesn't plant GMOs. He has a gut distrust of the technology. They're messing with 3 billion years of evolution, and doesn't think it's worth the extra $75 a bag in technology fees they cost. Sure, you might get a yield bump, but whatever you make on the extra corn goes right back to cover the premium for the seed. I fail to see why I should be laundering money from Monsanto. As Naylor sees it, GMO seed is just the latest chapter in an old story. Farmers eager to increase their yields adopt the latest innovation, only to find that it's the companies selling the innovations who reap the most from the gain in the farmer's productivity. Even without the addition of transgenes for traits like insect resistance, the standard F1 hybrids Naylor plants are technological marvels, capable of coaxing 180 bushels of corn from an acre of Iowa soil. One bushel holds 56 pounds of kernels, so that's slightly more than 10,000 pounds of food per acre. The field George and I planted that day would produce 1.8 million pounds of corn. Not bad for a day's work sitting down, I thought to myself that afternoon, though of course there'd be several more days of work between now and the harvest in October. One way to tell the story of this farm is by following the steady upward arc in the yield of corn. Naylor has no idea how many bushels of corn per acre his grandfather could produce, but the average back in 1920 was about 20 bushels per acre. Roughly the same yields historically realized by Native Americans. Corn then was planted in widely spaced bunches in a checkerboard pattern so farmers could easily cultivate between the stands in either direction. Hybrid seed came on the market in the late 1930s, when his father was farming. "You heard stories," George shouted over the din of the tractor. "How they talked him into raising an acre or two of the new hybrid, and by God, when the old corn fell over, the hybrid stood straight up. Doubled Dad's yields, till he was getting 70 to 80 an acre in the 50s. George has doubled that yet again, sometimes getting as much as 200 bushels of corn per acre. The only other domesticated species ever to have multiplied its productivity by such a factor is the Holstein cow. High yield is a fairly abstract concept, and I wondered what it meant at the level of the plant. More cobs per stalk? More kernels per cob? Neither of the above, Naylor explained. The higher yield of modern hybrids stems mainly from the fact that they can be planted so close together, 30,000 to the acre instead of 8,000 in his father's day. Planting the old open-pollinated, non-hybrid varieties so densely would result in stalks grown spindly as they jostle each other for sunlight. Eventually, the plants topple in the wind. Hybrids have been bred for thicker stalks and stronger root systems, the better to stand upright in a crowd and withstand mechanical harvesting. Basically, modern hybrids can tolerate the corn equivalent of city life, growing amid the multitudes without succumbing to urban stress. You would think that competition among individuals would threaten the tranquility of such a crowded metropolis, yet the modern field of corn forms a most orderly mob. This is because every plant in it, being an F1 hybrid, is genetically identical to every other. Since no individual plant has inherited any competitive edge over any other, precious resources like sunlight, water, and soil nutrients are shared equitably. There are no alpha corn plants to hog the light or fertilizer. The true socialist utopia turns out to be a field of F1 hybrid plants. Iowa begins to look a little different when you think of its sprawling fields as cities of corn. The land, in its own way, settled as densely as Manhattan for the very same purpose: to maximize real estate values. There may be little pavement, but this is no middle landscape. Though by any reasonable definition Iowa is a rural state, it is more thoroughly developed than many cities. A mere 2% of the state's land remains what it used to be: tall grass prairie, every square foot of the rest having been completely remade by man. The only thing missing from this man-made landscape is man. Vanishing species. A case can be made that the corn plant's population explosion in places like Iowa is responsible for pushing out not only other plants, but the animals and then finally the people too. When Naylor's grandfather arrived in America, the population of Greene County was near its peak, 16,467 people. In the most recent census, it had fallen to 10,366. There are many reasons for the depopulation of the American farm belt, but the triumph of corn deserves a large share of the blame, or the credit, depending on your point of view. When George Naylor's grandfather was farming, the typical Iowa farm was home to whole families of different plant and animal species, corn being only the fourth most common. Horses were the first, because every farm needed working animals. There were only 225 tractors in all of America in 1920, followed by cattle, chickens, and then corn. After corn came hogs, apples, hay, oats, potatoes, and cherries. Many Iowa farms also grew wheat, plums, grapes, and pears. This diversity allowed the farm not only to substantially feed itself, and by that I don't mean feed the farmers, but also the soil and the livestock, but to withstand a collapse in the market for any one of those crops. It also produced a completely different landscape than the Iowa of today. "You had fences everywhere," George recalled, "and of course pastures. Everyone had livestock, so large parts of the farm would be green most of the year. The ground never used to be this bare this long." For much of the year, from the October harvest to the emergence of the corn in mid-May, Greene County is black now, a great tarmac only slightly more hospitable to wildlife than asphalt. Even in May, the only green you see are the motes of lawn surrounding the houses, the narrow strips of grass dividing one farm from another, and the roadside ditches. The fences were pulled up when the animals left, beginning in the 50s and 60s, or when they moved indoors, as Iowa's hogs have more recently. Hogs now spend their lives in aluminum sheds perched atop manure pits. Greene County in the spring has become a monotonous landscape, vast plowed fields relieved only by a dwindling number of farmsteads, increasingly lonesome islands of white wood and green grass marooned in a sea of black. Without the fences and hedgerows to slow it down, Naylor says, the winds blow more fiercely in Iowa today than they once did. Corn isn't solely responsible for remaking this landscape. It was the tractor, after all, that put the horses out of work, and with the horses went the fields of oats and some of the pasture. But corn was the crop that put cash in the farmer's pocket. So as corn yields began to soar at mid-century, the temptation was to give the miracle crop more and more land. Of course, every other farmer in America was thinking the same way, having been encouraged to do so by government policies, with the inevitable result that the price of corn declined. One might think falling corn prices would lead farmers to plant less of it, but the economics and psychology of agriculture are such that exactly the opposite happened. Beginning in the 50s and 60s, the flood tide of cheap corn made it profitable to fatten cattle on feedlots instead of on grass, and to raise chickens in giant factories rather than in farmyards. Iowa farmers couldn't compete with the factory-farmed animals their own cheap corn had helped spawn, so the chickens and cattle disappeared from the farm, and with them the pastures and hayfields and fences. In their place, the farmers planted more of the one crop they could grow more of than anything else, corn. And whenever the price of corn slipped, they planted a little more of it to cover expenses and stay even. By the 1980s, the diversified family farm was history in Iowa, and corn was king. Planting corn on the same ground year after year brought down the predictable plagues of insects and disease. So beginning in the 1970s, Iowa farmers began to alternate corn with soybeans, a legume. Recently, though, bean prices having fallen and bean diseases having risen, some farmers are going back to a risky rotation of corn on corn. With the help of its human and botanical allies, that is, farm policy and soybeans, corn had pushed the animals and their feed crops off the land and steadily expanded into their paddocks and pastures and fields. Now it proceeded to push out the people. For the radically simplified farm of corn and soybeans doesn't require nearly as much human labor as the old diversified farm, especially when the farmer can call on 16-row planters and chemical weed killers. One man can handle a lot more acreage by himself when it's planted in monoculture, and without animals to care for, he can take the weekend off and even think about spending the winter in Florida. Growing corn is just riding tractors and spraying, Naylor said. The number of riding and spraying days it takes to raise 500 acres of industrial corn can probably be counted in weeks. So the farms got bigger, and eventually the people, who the steadily falling price of corn could no longer support anyway, went elsewhere, ceding the field to the monstrous grass. Today, Chardon is virtually a ghost town, most of its main street shuttered. The barbershop, a food market, and the local movie theater have all closed in recent years. There's a cafe and one sparsely stocked little market somehow still hanging on, but most people drive the 10 miles to Jefferson to buy their groceries or pick up milk and eggs when they're getting gas at the come-and-go. The middle school can no longer field a baseball team or put together a band, it has so few students left, and it takes 4 local high schools to field a single football team. The Jefferson, Scranton, Peyton, Chardon Rams. Just about the only going concern left standing in Chardon is the grain elevator, rising at the far end of town like a windowless concrete skyscraper. It endures because, people or no people, the corn keeps coming, more of it every year. There goes the sun. I've oversimplified the story a bit. Corn's rapid rise is not quite as self-propelled as I've made it sound. As in so many other self-made American successes, the closer you look, the more you find the federal government lending a hand. A patent, a monopoly, a tax break, to our hero at a critical juncture. In the case of corn, the botanical hero I've depicted as plucky and ambitious was in fact subsidized in crucial ways, both economically and biologically. There's a good reason I met farmers in Iowa who don't respect corn, who will tell you in disgust that the plant has become a welfare queen. The great turning point in the modern history of corn, which in turn marks a key turning point in the industrialization of our food, can be dated with some precision to the day in 1947 when the huge munitions plant at Muscle Shoals, Alabama, switched over to making chemical fertilizer. After the war, the government had found itself with a tremendous surplus of ammonium nitrate, the principal ingredient in the making of explosives. Ammonium nitrate also happens to be an excellent source of nitrogen for plants. Serious thought was given to spraying America's forests with the surplus chemical to help out the timber industry. But agronomists in the Department of Agriculture had a better idea. Spread the ammonium nitrate on farmland as fertilizer. The chemical fertilizer industry, along with that of pesticides, which are based on poison gases developed for the war, is the product of the government's effort to convert its war machine to peacetime purposes. As the Indian farmer activist Vandana Shiva says in her speeches, we're still eating the leftovers of World War II. Hybrid corn turned out to be the greatest beneficiary of this conversion. Hybrid corn is the greediest of plants, consuming more fertilizer than any other crop. For though the new hybrids had the genes to make it in teeming cities of corn, the richest acre of Iowa soil could never have fed 30,000 hungry corn plants without promptly bankrupting its fertility. To keep their land from getting corn sick, farmers in Naylor's Father's Day would carefully rotate their crops with legumes, which add nitrogen to the soil, never growing corn more than twice in the same field every 5 years. They would also recycle nutrients by spreading their cornfields with manure from their livestock. Before synthetic fertilizers, the amount of nitrogen in the soil strictly limited the amount of corn an acre of land could support. Though hybrids were introduced in the 30s, it wasn't until they made the acquaintance of chemical fertilizers in the 1950s that corn yields exploded. The discovery of synthetic nitrogen changed everything. Not just for the corn plant and the farm, not just for the food system, but also for the way life on Earth is conducted. All life depends on nitrogen. It is the building block from which nature assembles amino acids, proteins, and nucleic acid. The genetic information that orders and perpetuates life is written in nitrogen ink. This is why scientists speak of nitrogen as supplying life's quality, while carbon provides the quantity. But the supply of usable nitrogen on Earth is limited. Although Earth's atmosphere is about 80% nitrogen, all those atoms are tightly paired, non-reactive, and therefore useless. The 19th century chemist Justus von Liebig spoke of atmospheric nitrogen's indifference to all other substances. To be of any value to plants and animals, these self-involved nitrogen atoms must be split and then joined to atoms of hydrogen. Chemists call this process of taking atoms from the atmosphere and combining them into molecules useful to living things, fixing that element. Until a German-Jewish chemist named Fritz Haber figured out how to turn this trick in 1909, all the usable nitrogen on Earth had at one time been fixed by soil bacteria living on the roots of leguminous plants, such as peas or alfalfa or locust trees, or, less commonly, by the shock of electrical lightning, which can break nitrogen bonds in the air, releasing a light rain of fertility. Vaclav Smil, a geographer who has written a fascinating book about Fritz Haber called Enriching the Earth, pointed out that there is no way to grow crops and human bodies without nitrogen. Before Fritz Haber's invention, the sheer amount of life Earth could support, the size of crops and therefore the number of human bodies, was limited by the amount of nitrogen that bacteria and lightning could fix. By 1900, European scientists recognized that unless a way was found to augment this naturally occurring nitrogen, the growth of the human population would soon grind to a very painful halt. The same recognition by Chinese scientists a few decades later is probably what compelled China's opening to the West. After Nixon's 1972 trip, the first major order the Chinese government placed was for 13 massive fertilizer factories. Without them, China would probably have starved. This is why it may not be hyperbole to claim, as Smil does, that the Haber-Bosch process, Carl Bosch gets the credit for commercializing Haber's idea, for fixing nitrogen is the most important invention of the 20th century. He estimates that 2 of every 5 humans on Earth today would not be alive if not for Fritz Haber's invention. We can easily imagine a world without computers or electricity, Smil points out, but without synthetic fertilizer, billions of people would never have been born. Though, as these numbers suggest, humans may have struck something of a Faustian bargain with nature when Fritz Haber gave us the power to fix nitrogen. Fritz Haber? No, I'd never heard of him either, even though he was awarded the Nobel Prize in 1920 for improving the standards of agriculture and the well-being of mankind. But the reason for his obscurity has less to do with the importance of his work than the ugly twist of his biography, which recalls the dubious links between modern warfare and industrial agriculture. During World War I, Haber threw himself into the German war effort, and his chemistry kept alive Germany's hopes for victory. After Britain choked off Germany's supply of nitrates from Chilean mines, an essential ingredient in the manufacture of explosives, Haber's technology allowed Germany to continue making bombs from synthetic nitrate. Later, as the war became mired in the trenches of France, Haber put his genius for chemistry to work developing poison gases, ammonia, then chlorine. He subsequently developed Zyklon B, the gas used in Hitler's concentration camps. On April 22, 1915, Smil writes, Haber was on the front lines directing the first gas attack in military history. His triumphant return to Berlin was ruined a few days later when his wife, a chemist sickened by her husband's contribution to the war effort, used Haber's army pistol to kill herself. Though Haber later converted to Christianity, his Jewish background forced him to flee Nazi Germany in the 30s. He died, broken, in a Basel hotel room in 1934. Perhaps because the history of science gets written by the victors, Fritz Haber's story has been all but written out of the 20th century. Not even a plaque marks the site of his great discovery at the University of Karlsruhe. Haber's story embodies the paradoxes of science, the double edge to our manipulations of nature, the good and evil that can flow not only from the same man, but the same knowledge. Haber brought a vital new source of fertility and an awful new weapon into the world. As his biographer wrote, it's the same science and the same man doing both. Yet this dualism dividing the benefactor of agriculture from the chemical weapons maker is far too pat, for even Haber's benefaction has proven to be a decidedly mixed blessing. When humankind acquired the power to fix nitrogen, the basis of soil fertility shifted from a total reliance on the energy of the sun to a new reliance on fossil fuel. For the Haber-Bosch process works by combining nitrogen and hydrogen gases under immense heat and pressure in the presence of a catalyst. The heat and pressure are supplied by prodigious amounts of electricity, and the hydrogen is supplied by oil, coal, or most commonly today, natural gas. Fossil fuels. True, these fossil fuels were at one time, billions of years ago, created by the sun, but they are not renewable in the same way that the fertility created by a legume nourished by sunlight is. That nitrogen is actually fixed by a bacteria living on the roots of the legume, which trades a tiny drip of sugar for the nitrogen the plant needs. On the day in the 1950s that George Naylor's father spread his first load of ammonium nitrate fertilizer, the ecology of his farm underwent a quiet revolution. What had been a local, sun-driven cycle of fertility, in which the legumes fed the corn, which fed the livestock, which in turn, with their manure, fed the corn, was now broken. Now he could plant corn every year and on as much of his acreage as he chose, since he had no need for the legumes or the animal manure. He could buy fertility in a bag, fertility that had originally been produced a billion years ago, halfway around the world. Liberated from the old biological constraints, the farm could now be managed on industrial principles, as a factory transforming inputs of raw material, chemical fertilizer, into outputs of corn. Since the farm no longer needs to generate and conserve its own fertility by maintaining a diversity of species, synthetic fertilizer opens the way to monoculture, allowing the farmer to bring the factory's economies of scale and mechanical efficiency to nature. If, as has sometimes been said, the discovery of agriculture represented the first fall of man from the state of nature, then the discovery of synthetic fertility is surely a second precipitous fall. Fixing nitrogen allowed the food chain to turn from the logic of biology and embrace the logic of industry. Instead of eating exclusively from the sun, humanity now began to sip petroleum. Corn adapted brilliantly to the new industrial regime, consuming prodigious quantities of fossil fuel energy and turning out ever more prodigious quantities of food energy. More than half of all the synthetic nitrogen made today is applied to corn, whose hybrid strains can make better use of it than any other plant. Growing corn, which from a biological perspective had always been a process of capturing sunlight to turn it into food, has in no small measure become a process of converting fossil fuels into food. This shift explains the color of the land. The reason Greene County is no longer green for half the year is because the farmer who can buy synthetic fertility no longer needs cover crops to capture a whole year's worth of sunlight. He has plugged himself into a new source of energy. When you add together the natural gas in the fertilizer to the fossil fuels it takes to make the pesticides, drive the tractors, and harvest, dry, and transport the corn, you find that every bushel of industrial corn requires the equivalent of a quarter to a third of a gallon of oil to grow it, or around 50 gallons of oil per acre of corn. Some estimates are much higher. Put another way, it takes more than a calorie of fossil fuel energy to produce a calorie of food. Before the advent of chemical fertilizer, the Naylor farm produced more than 2 calories of food energy for every calorie of energy invested. From the standpoint of industrial efficiency, it's too bad we can't simply drink the petroleum directly, because there's a lot less energy in a bushel of corn, measured in calories, than there is in the half gallon of oil required to produce it. Ecologically, this is a fabulously expensive way to produce food. But ecologically is no longer the operative standard. As long as fossil fuel energy is so cheap and available, it makes good economic sense to produce corn this way. The old way of growing corn, using fertility drawn from the sun, may have been the biological equivalent of a free lunch, but the service was much slower and the portions were much skimpier. In the factory, time is money, and yield is everything. One problem with factories, as compared to biological systems, is that they tend to pollute. Hungry for fossil fuel as hybrid corn is, farmers still feed it far more than it can possibly eat, wasting most of the fertilizer they buy. Maybe it's applied at the wrong time of year. Maybe it runs off the fields in the rain. Maybe the farmer puts down extra just to play it safe. They say you only need 100 pounds per acre. I don't know. I'm putting on up to 200. You don't want to err on the side of too little, Naylor explained to me a bit sheepishly. It's a form of yield insurance. But what happens to the 100 pounds of synthetic nitrogen that Naylor's corn plants don't take up? Some of it evaporates into the air, where it acidifies the rain and contributes to global warming. Ammonium nitrate is transformed into nitrous oxide, an important greenhouse gas. Some seeps down to the water table. When I went to pour myself a glass of water in the Naylor's kitchen, Peggy made sure I drew it from a special faucet connected to a reverse osmosis filtration system in the basement. As for the rest of the excess nitrogen, the spring rains wash it off Naylor's fields, carrying it into drainage ditches that eventually spill into the Raccoon River. From there it flows into the Des Moines River, down to the city of Des Moines, which drinks from the Des Moines River. In spring, when nitrogen runoff is at its heaviest, the city issues blue baby alerts, warning parents it's unsafe to give children water from the tap. The nitrates in the water bind to hemoglobin, compromising the blood's ability to carry oxygen to the brain. So I guess I was wrong to suggest we don't sip fossil fuels directly. Sometimes we do. It has been less than a century since Fritz Haber's invention, yet already it has changed Earth's ecology. More than half of the world's supply of usable nitrogen is now man-made. Unless you grew up on organic food, most of the kilo or so of nitrogen in your body was fixed by the Haber-Bosch process. "We have perturbed the global nitrogen cycle," Smil wrote, "more than any other, even carbon. The effects may be harder to predict than the effects of the global warming caused by our disturbance of the carbon cycle, but they are no less momentous. The flood of synthetic nitrogen has fertilized not just the farm fields, but the forests and the oceans too, to the benefit of some species, corn and algae being two of the biggest beneficiaries, and to the detriment of countless others. The ultimate fate of the nitrates that George Naylor spreads on his cornfield in Iowa is to flow down the Mississippi into the Gulf of Mexico, where their deadly fertility poisons the marine ecosystem. The nitrogen tide stimulates the wild growth of algae, and the algae smother the fish, creating a hypoxic, or dead, zone as big as the state of New Jersey, and still growing. By fertilizing the world, we alter the planet's composition of species and shrink its biodiversity. A plague of cheap corn. The day after George Naylor and I finished planting his corn, the rains came, so we spent most of it around his kitchen table, drinking coffee and talking about what farmers always talk about: lousy commodity prices, benighted farm policies, making ends meet in a dysfunctional farm economy. Naylor came back to the farm at what would turn out to be the good old days in American agriculture. Corn prices were at an all-time high, and it looked as though it might actually be possible to make a living growing it. But by the time Naylor was ready to take his first crop to the elevator, the price of a bushel of corn had dropped from $3 to $2, the result of a bumper crop. So he held his corn off the market, storing it in the hope that the price would rebound. But the price kept falling all through that winter and into the following spring, and, if you factor in inflation, it has pretty much been falling ever since. These days, the price of a bushel of corn is about a dollar beneath the true cost of growing it, a boon for everyone but the corn farmer. What I was hoping George Naylor could help me understand is, if there's so much corn being grown in America today that the market won't pay the cost of producing it, then why would any farmer in his right mind plant another acre of it? The answer is complicated, as I would learn, but it has something to do with the perverse economics of agriculture, which would seem to defy the classical laws of supply and demand, a little to do with the psychology of farmers, and everything to do with farm policies, which underwent a revolution right around the time George Naylor was buying his first tractor. Government farm programs once designed to limit production and support prices, and therefore farmers, were quietly rejiggered to increase production and drive down prices. Put another way, instead of supporting farmers, during the Nixon administration, the government began supporting corn at the expense of farmers. Corn, already the recipient of a biological subsidy in the form of synthetic nitrogen, would now receive an economic subsidy too, ensuring its final triumph over the land and the food system. Naylor's perspective on farm policy was shaped by a story his dad used to tell him. It takes place during the winter of 1933, at the depths of the farm depression. That's when my father hauled corn to town and found out that the price of corn had been 10 cents a bushel the day before, but on that day the elevator wasn't even buying. The price of corn had fallen to zero. Tears always came to his eyes when he recounted the neighbors losing their farms in the 1920s and 30s, Naylor told me. America's farm policy was forged during the Depression not, as many people seem to think, to encourage farmers to produce more food for a hungry nation, but to rescue farmers from the disastrous effects of growing too much food, far more than Americans could afford to buy. For as long as people have been farming, fat years have posed almost as stiff a challenge as lean, since crop surpluses collapse prices and bankrupt farmers who will be needed again when the inevitable lean years return. When it comes to food, nature can make a mockery of the classical economics of supply and demand. Nature in the form of good or bad weather, of course, but also the nature of the human body, which can consume only so much food no matter how plentiful the supply. So, going back to the Old Testament, communities have devised various strategies to even out the destructive swings of agricultural production. The Bible's recommended farm policy was to establish a grain reserve. Not only did this ensure that when drought or pestilence ruined a harvest, there'd still be food to eat, but it kept farmers whole by taking food off the market when the harvest was bountiful. This is more or less what New Deal farm programs attempted to do. For storable commodities such as corn, the government established a target price based on the cost of production, and whenever the market price dropped below that target, the farmer was given a choice. Instead of dumping corn onto a weak market, thereby weakening it further, the farmer could take out a loan from the government, using his crop as collateral that allowed him to store his grain until prices recovered. At that point, he sold the corn and paid back the loan. If corn prices stayed low, he could elect to keep the money he'd borrowed and, in repayment, give the government his corn, which would then go into something that came to be called, rather quaintly, the ever-normal granary. Other New Deal programs, such as those administered by the Soil Conservation Service, sought to avert overproduction and soil erosion by encouraging farmers to idle their most environmentally sensitive land. The system, which remained in place more or less until shortly before George Naylor came back to the farm in the 1970s, did a fairly good job of keeping corn prices from collapsing in the face of the 20th century's rapid gains in yield. Surpluses were held off the market by the offer of these non-recourse loans, which cost the government relatively little, since most of the loans were eventually repaid. And when prices climbed, as a result of bad weather, say, the government sold corn from its granary, which helped both to pay for the farm programs and smooth out the inevitable swings in price. I say this system remained in place more or less until the 1970s because, beginning in the 1950s, a campaign to dismantle the New Deal farm programs took root, and with every new farm bill since then, another strut has been removed from the structure of support. Almost from the start, the policy of supporting prices and limiting production had collected powerful enemies. Exponents of laissez-faire economics, who didn't see why farming should be treated differently than any other economic sector. Food processors and grain exporters, who profited from overproduction and low crop prices. And a coalition of political and business leaders who, for various reasons, thought America had far too many farmers for her, or at least their, own good. America's farmers had long been making political trouble for Wall Street and Washington. In the words of historian Walter Karp, since the Civil War at least, the most unruly, the most independent, the most Republican of American citizens have been the small farmers. Beginning with the populist revolt of the 1890s, farmers had made common cause with the labor movement, working together to check the power of corporations. Rising agricultural productivity handed a golden opportunity to the farmers' traditional adversaries. Since a smaller number of farmers could now feed America, the moment had come to rationalize agriculture by letting the market force prices down and farmers off the land. So Wall Street and Washington sought changes in farm policies that would loose a plague of cheap corn, in the words of Naylor, a man very much in the old rural populist mold, on the nation, the effects of which are all around us. Indeed, in us. The Sage of Purdue. Earl Rusty Butz, Richard Nixon's second Secretary of Agriculture, probably did more than any other single individual to orchestrate George Naylor's plague of cheap corn. In every newspaper article about him, and there were scores, the name of Earl Butz, a blustering, highly quotable agricultural economist from Purdue University, is invariably accompanied by the epithet colorful. Butz's plain-spoken manner and barnyard humor persuaded many people he must be a friend to the farmer, but his presence on the board of Ralston Purina probably offered a more reliable guide to his sympathies. Though chiefly remembered outside agriculture for the racist joke that cost him his job during the 1976 election, Butz revolutionized American agriculture, helping to shift the food chain onto a foundation of cheap corn. Butz took over the Department of Agriculture during the last period in American history that food prices climbed high enough to generate real political heat. His legacy would be to make sure that never happened again. In the fall of 1972, Russia, having suffered a series of disastrous harvests, purchased 30 million tons of American grain. Butts had helped arrange the sale in the hopes of giving a boost to crop prices in order to bring restive farmers tempted to vote for George McGovern into the Republican fold. The plan worked all too well. The unexpected surge in demand, coinciding with a spell of bad weather in the Farm Belt, drove grain prices to historic heights. These were the corn prices that persuaded George Naylor he could make a go of it on his family's farm. The 1972 Russian grain sale and the resulting spike in farm income that fall helped Nixon nail down the farm vote for his re-election. But by the following year, those prices had reverberated through the food chain, all the way to the supermarket. By 1973, the inflation rate for groceries reached an all-time high, and housewives were organizing protests at supermarkets. Farmers were killing chicks because they couldn't afford to buy feed, and the price of beef was slipping beyond the reach of middle-class consumers. Some foods became scarce. Horse meat began showing up in certain markets. "Why a food scare in the land of plenty?" was a headline in U.S. News and World Report that summer. Nixon had a consumer revolt on his hands, and he dispatched Earl Butts to quell it. The sage of Purdue set to work re-engineering the American food system, driving down prices and vastly increasing the output of American farmers. What had long been the dream of agribusiness, cheaper raw materials, and the political establishment, fewer restive farmers, now became official government policy. Butts made no secret of his agenda. He exhorted farmers to plant their fields fence row to fence row, and advised them to get big or get out. Bigger farms were more productive, he believed, so he pushed farmers to consolidate. Adapt or die was another of his credos, and to regard themselves not as farmers but as agribusinessmen. Somewhat less noisily, Butts set to work dismantling the New Deal farm regime of price support, a job made easier by the fact that prices at the time were so high. He abolished the ever-normal granary and, with the 1973 Farm Bill, began replacing the New Deal system of supporting prices through loans, government grain purchases, and land idling with a new system of direct payments to farmers. The change from loans to direct payments hardly seems momentous. Either way, the government pledged to make sure the farmer receives some target price for a bushel of corn when prices are weak. But in fact, paying farmers directly for the shortfall in the price of corn was revolutionary, as its proponents surely must have understood. They had removed the floor under the price of grain. Instead of keeping corn out of a falling market, as the old loan programs and federal granary had done, the new subsidies encouraged farmers to sell their corn at any price, since the government would make up the difference. Or, as it turned out, make up some of the difference, since just about every farm bill since has lowered the target price in order, it was claimed, to make American grain more competitive in world markets. Beginning in the 1980s, big buyers of grain like Cargill and Archer Daniels Midland, ADM, took a hand in shaping the farm bills, which predictably came to reflect their interests more closely than those of farmers. Instead of supporting farmers, the government was now subsidizing every bushel of corn a farmer could grow. And American farmers pushed to go flat out could grow a hell of a lot of corn. The Naylor Curve. It's not at all clear that very many American farmers know exactly what hit them even now. The rhetoric of competitiveness and free trade persuaded many of them that cheap corn would be their salvation, and several putative farmers' organizations have bought into the virtues of cheap corn. But since the heyday of corn prices in the early 70s, farm income has steadily declined along with corn prices, forcing millions of farmers deeper into debt and thousands of them into bankruptcy every week. Exports, as a percentage of the American corn harvest, have barely budged from around 20%, even as prices have fallen. Iowa State University estimates that it costs roughly $2.50 to grow a bushel of Iowa corn. In October 2005, Iowa grain elevators were paying $1.45. So the typical Iowa farmer is selling corn for a dollar less than it costs him to grow it. Yet the corn keeps coming, more of it every year. How can this possibly be? George Naylor has studied this question, and he has come up with a convincing answer. He's often asked to speak at meetings on the farm crisis and to testify at hearings about farm policy, where he often presents a graph he's drawn to explain the mystery. He calls it the Naylor curve. Remember the Laffer curve? Well, this one looks a little like that one, only it's true. Basically, it purports to show why falling farm prices force farmers to increase production in defiance of all rational economic behavior. Farmers facing lower prices have only one option if they want to be able to maintain their standard of living, pay their bills, and service their debt, and that is to produce more. A farm family needs a certain amount of cash flow every year to support itself, and if the price of corn falls, the only way to stay even is to sell more corn. Naylor says that farmers desperate to increase yield end up degrading their land, plowing and planting marginal land, applying more nitrogen, anything to squeeze a few more bushels from the soil. Yet the more bushels each farmer produces, the lower prices go, giving another turn to the perverse spiral of overproduction. Even so, corn farmers persist in measuring their success in bushels per acre, a measurement that improves even as they go broke. The free market has never worked in agriculture, and it never will. The economics of a family farm are very different than a firm's. When prices fall, the firm can lay off people, idle factories, and make fewer widgets. Eventually, the market finds a new balance between supply and demand. But the demand for food isn't elastic. People don't eat more just because food is cheap. And laying off farmers doesn't help to reduce supply. You can fire me, but you can't fire my land because some other farmer who needs more cash flow or thinks he's more efficient than I am will come in and farm it. Even if I go out of business, this land will keep producing corn. But why corn and not something else? We're on the bottom rung of the industrial food chain here, using this land to produce energy and protein, mostly to feed animals. Corn is the most efficient way to produce energy. Soybeans, the most efficient way to produce protein. The notion of switching to some other crop, Naylor gruffly dismisses. What am I going to grow here? Broccoli? Lettuce? We've got a long-term investment in growing corn and soybeans. The elevator is the only buyer in town, and the elevator only pays me for corn and soybeans. The market is telling me to grow corn and soybeans, period. As is the government, which calculates his various subsidy payments based on his yield of corn. So the plague of cheap corn goes on, impoverishing farmers, both here and in the countries where we sell it, degrading the land, polluting the water, and bleeding the federal treasury, which now spends up to $5 billion a year subsidizing cheap corn. But though that subsidy check goes to the farmer and represents nearly half of net farm income today, what the Treasury is really subsidizing are the buyers of all that cheap corn. Agriculture's always going to be organized by the government. The question is, organized for whose benefit? Now it's for Cargill and Coca-Cola. It's certainly not for the farmer. Early that afternoon, after George and I had been talking agricultural policy for longer than I ever thought possible, the phone rang. His neighbor, Billy, needed a hand with a balky corn planter. On the drive over, Naylor told me a little about Billy. He's got all the latest toys. The 12-row planter, Roundup Ready Seed, the new John Deere combine. George rolled his eyes. Billy's in debt up to his eyeballs. George believes he's managed to survive on the farm by steering clear of debt, nursing along his antique combine and tractor, and avoiding the trap of expansion. A blockish fellow in his 50s, with a seed cap perched over a graying crew cut, Billy seemed cheerful enough, especially considering he'd just blown his morning fiddling with a broken tractor cable. While he and George were working, I checked out the shed full of state-of-the-art farm equipment and asked him what he thought about the BT corn he was planting, corn genetically engineered to produce its own pesticide. Billy thought the seed was the greatest. "I'm getting 220 bushels an acre on that seed," he boasted. "How's that compare, George?" George owned he was getting something just south of 200, but he was too polite to say what he knew, which was that he was almost certainly clearing more money per acre growing less corn more cheaply. But in Iowa, bragging rights go to the man with the biggest yield, even if it's bankrupting him.